Thank you, Estelle, for this kind introduction and also for inviting me to this virtual talk. It's great to present my work in front of this audience. And so I'm a chemist, as I hope is kind of evident by now. Why is my screen not moving? Okay. So I'm a chemist and I am interested in excited state chemistry of actually condensed phase systems. And that includes biological systems or material systems and so on. And therefore I develop hybrid QMMM methods for excited states. One part of those QMMM methods would be the fragment-based or machine learning-based polarizable force fields. Because in this situation, polarizability is extremely required to take into consideration the perturbative effect of the environment. But the excited states itself, as in the active site of a protein, let's say, or you name it, the most important part of a material system, that would be strongly correlated. And for that, we develop some methods that are based on matrix product states or tensor product states and so on. And once these methods are developed, we like to apply them to systems that are of interest to us. For example, the photoprotection property of melanin, or the spectroscopic properties of fluorescent proteins, RNA, and so on. So if I kind of give, today I'm going to talk about mostly the strong correlation part, but before that, let me kind of motivate the kind of systems that I am interested in and why I would like to study it in such a way. So over the last few years, for example, our group has been studying singlet fission. So what is singlet fission? Let's say if we have two chromophores which are close to each other, if it's in a material system, it would be packed close to each other. And if there are two chromophores thus, in close proximity, and if light falls on it, one of the chromophore, depending on the geometry and so on, might get excited to the optically active singlet state. Once that singlet state is formed, it can actually come down to two triplet states. So this is a coupled triplet state. And one might think that, okay, a singlet to triplet transition is spin forbidden. However, because there are two coupled triplets that are formed, you can see that this is an overall singlet spin state. Therefore, it is a spin allowed transition. And this can actually lead to energy, materials that are good for solar energy harvesting. And here, actually, the kind of systems that are important has been shown. For example, these acene systems or polyene systems like carotenoids and so on. And the question here that one would like to address is, what is the mechanism and electronic structure of the states that are involved in the singlet fission? And the aim, of course, down the line is to be able to engineer such molecules by knowing its electronic structure or the mechanism and so on. So this is essentially the process that is going on in the potential energy surface picture. Another system of interest, as I have already mentioned, is in biology, in photoprotection in melanin. So you can see in this panel over here, the left-hand side. Melanin is formed of monomers, which are actually dihydroxyindole. And the dihydroxyindole spectra has nice features like you would expect from an organic molecule. However, once you go into the eumelanin structure, you see these are very flat spectra. In other words, it is absorbing all the light that is incident on it. That's great for us because that's how eumelanin actually protects us from sunlight. So it basically sops up all the energy that is incident on, let's say, a human skin. But the problem that we encounter on the other hand is characterizing these structures. So, I know what the monomer is, but what is the final polymeric structure of melanin? That's an answer that still eludes us. So to understand this monotonic and featureless spectra of melanin is a holy grail problem in melanin chemistry and biophysics. Another question we have tried to address is what happens to melanin after it absorbs that light? As in, how does it quench all of that energy that is incident on it so that it does not harm its own structure? So those are the questions that we are trying to address. And in our quest to understand such processes, essentially we have to look at the potential energy surface that looks as complicated as this. So let's say this is the ground state structure of any species, let it be biological or material or whatever. Once light shines on it, it goes to the first optically active state or the optically allowed state. And from then onwards, this essentially there are very many different paths that it can take, very many different geometries that it samples to various crossings. You know, for example, there could be a singlet-triplet crossing or a singlet-singlet conical intersection crossing and so on. And then it kind of quenches its way back to the ground state happy geometry. So this this whole kind of the molecular movie of what happens to a system after it absorbs light is kind of central theme in our group. And essentially this would be a field that includes spectroscopy, electronic structure theory, molecular dynamics, because there's so many different structural features that are possible and so on. That's the question at the heart of our research. Now, what's the problem involved in this? So if I can take a very small molecule, and I will try to explain the problem one encounters in this, in understanding these systems. So this is a water molecule, oxygen, two hydrogens. And if I pull the bonds apart, so essentially I'm trying to elongate the OH bonds, both of the OH bonds together. This is the what a quantum chemist would find. So this is a full CI. The black curve over here is the full CI or the exact solution. But if you use any of the traditional quantum chemistry methods, such as coupled cluster, which is kind of taken as the gold standard of quantum chemistry, or perturbative approximations such as MP2, even if you take DFT, whatever. So this is the kind of a strange bump, and then it goes down. That's the potential energy surface one encounters, which is clearly wrong, because what should happen at infinite separation is they should become just, you know, radicals, and it should go to smoothly to the energy of one oxygen atom and two hydrogen atoms. That's it. And if I plot the errors, this is what it would look like. And the sad thing for a chemist would be that when I'm trying to break a bond, because that's what a chemist does, breaks a bond and makes a bond, that's where the errors become really, really large. And in fact, it would go to minus infinity at one point because it will not converge. So these effects, this kind of effect is not just seen in bond breaking problem or bond formation problem. This is seen in excited states, which is what I am interested in. Diradicals, triradicals, transition metal complexes, polyenes, graphenes, metal clusters, you name it. So all the interesting chemistry seems to encounter, or much of the interesting chemistry seems to encounter this problem. And the reason for that is, instead of having this single reference or mean field approximation, we basically need a multi-reference or multi-configuration configurational methods, at least in the Phelan space. So that basically means, again, as a chemist, I'm very familiar with the single reference molecular orbital picture, where I have n number of orbitals and I put electrons in orbitals starting from the lowest energy and go up to the highest occupied molecular orbital. And from the LUMO onwards, everything is empty. On the other hand, what really happens is, because interesting chemistry means that we are in this interface region where the valence space is closely spaced, as in the orbitals in the valence space, space are near degenerate. Therefore, instead of having a single configuration of electrons, I would have many, many, many different configurations. Here I've shown just four, because of course I've taken only two orbitals, but the valence space would be much bigger than that. And so the number of configurations would be much, much larger. So that's what we need to consider. Now let's see what that would entail. Again, I am taking the example of the polyaromatic hydrocarbons because this is interesting in the context of the singlet fission problem that I mentioned, because polyacenes are, pentacene, tetracene, those were the best candidates, or at least the earliest observed best candidates for singlet fission. So the number of CSFs, or number of configurations in the valence space or the active space, increases exponentially with the size of the valence space. So if I have a molecule which has, let's say, 30 carbon atoms, that would mean that on each of those carbon atoms, there are p orbitals. So that would mean there are 30 pi orbitals with 30 electrons in them. And if I count the number of CSFs that are possible, that would be 10 to the power 33. So that's really a huge number. And forming a Hamiltonian over that full CSF space and diagonalizing this would be a Herculean task. I mean, it's not possible. And the reason for that, again, I probably don't need to belabor in this crowd, is, if I take the example of spin systems, if I have one site with a spin up or down, the number of possibilities are two. And if I have n such sites, essentially it goes to 2 to the power n. I actually don't have spin sites. I essentially have orbitals. So instead of two, I have four possibilities, as in an orbital can be empty. It can be upspin only, downspin only, or doubly occupied. So there are four possibilities. And given those four possibilities, the full Fock space would be 4 to the power n. Of course, once you have a certain constraints on the number of electrons and stuff like that, you reduce the number, but it would still be an exponentially scaling problem. And another way of posing that same problem would be to write the full CI, or the exact wave function, as in the occupation number formalism, as this. In the matrix product state notation, this is what that looks like. So essentially, I have these different orbitals, which gives the different dimensions. And here I'm denoting each of those different dimensions as the basically those prongs of kind of like a comb-like object. Again, I don't know about really whether I should be explaining this part to this audience, but I'm going to go ahead and explain it anyways. So in the matrix product state notation, if I have a real valued number or a complex valued number, not a vector, not a matrix or anything like that, single number, then that is denoted by a circle with, notice, no legs. So there's no dimension sticking out of it. If I have a vector, therefore it has a single dimension, so a single hand or leg, whichever you may say. And I have written the index of that dimension as I over here. Similarly, for a matrix, there would be two hands. For a five-dimensional tensor, this is what it would look like. So if I were to do a matrix vector multiplication or a contraction, this is what it would look like. And you can see over here that the contracted index, so the J index over which I've summed over, kind of vanishes after this operation. So this also vanishes after this operation, because at the end you have, after the matrix vector multiplication, you have an object with a single dimension sticking out. So it's a vector. Similarly, a trace would look like this, and so on. You kind of get the point. So in the matrix product answers, as I mentioned, the exact wave function should look like this in algebraic notation, and like this object in the pictorial representation. And the number of values, or number of parameters involved in it, would be d to the power n, 4 to the power n in my case. So if I do a singular value decomposition on this object such that I take one of the dimensions as a real dimension and the rest of them as, say like a composite dimension, so I have essentially, I've flattened this many dimensional tensor into a matrix which has one dimension on one side and a complex many dimensions on the other side. So it's a very oblong object, I guess. And if I perform a singular value decomposition on that, this is what it would look like. So the first, it is a matrix times a diagonal matrix times another matrix. Again, you notice the rest of the indices are kind of this compositive index. I've just kept it as is. And if I keep doing this over and over again, essentially I would have a matrix product state. So essentially a matrix times a tensor and so on. And this also sometimes referred to as tensor trains, but notwithstanding whatever the name is, the total number of parameters involved in this final form would be n times d times m squared. So here m is basically the dimension of the shared index. So it's the it's called the bond dimension. It's essentially a degree of how much entanglement there is between these two adjacent sites or adjacent orbitals. And by adjacent, I don't necessarily mean spatially adjacent. It's basically the most entangled ones are adjacent to each other. And as you move farther and further away, the entanglement decreases. It could be spatial, it could be otherwise also. So that's the M involved over here. And since there are N of these objects, that's why the N is involved. And the D comes about because there's still this dimension sticking out. So if you think of this object would be D times M squared. And there are N of them, just kind of, we have taken the end objects also as similar, let's say. That would give a dimension of n times d times m squared. So notice the great thing that has happened over here is the dimensionality with the system size has gone from the exponent to the mantissa. So ideally, it looks like an exponential saving. But of course, we don't know how the m scales on the total system size. And if I had a really linear system and fast decaying entanglement, then I would have M, which is totally independent of N, and that would be fantastic. Okay. So one way to solve this problem is to use a density matrix renormalization group. So what goes on over there is, as I mentioned before, this is how a full CI wave function would look. And very soon, even though here it looks like there's only 8 such possibilities. However, if I had n sites, the number of possibilities would be too much. And the cost of computation, cost of storing, everything would be really impossible to handle. But what one can do is after they have created the all possible combinations of spins for the two sites, the first two adjacent sites, we can actually look at their density matrix and diagonalize it and keep only the most, the highest weights or the highest, highest values of that, those diagonal, along that diagonal direction. If we do that, we are essentially retaining the most important part of the physics of the system while not letting the system size get out of hand. And I can, after doing this operation of reducing the degrees of freedom, I can again take the next site into consideration, take all possible combinations that are possible, and keep doing this over and over again. Here I have, for a cartoon, I've shown that I've kept the degrees of freedom as 2. And static at 2. Of course, it does not work that nicely. We have to keep M or the bond dimension or the number of degrees of freedom retained has to be quite high, but it still does not increase with system size if we have a linear, almost linear system. So if I were to kind of summarize what that means, is of course I have a full CI wave function which is which is exponentially scaling. The mean field approximation that we are that is kind of our familiar starting point looks like this, where essentially you have a product of orbitals, of course anti-symmetrized, but product of orbitals. So there's no correlation between them. On the other hand, what we have done right now using this matrix product state, you can say, or density matrix renormalization group, is we have added another degree of freedom, which is kind of the entanglement degree of freedom between adjacent sites. And depending on how many of these entanglement degree you need to retain, DMRG basically gives us a good algorithm to determine these matrix product states. And as long as the dimension of the matrix products, or that M, remains reasonable, we really have a pretty general answer that is very economical. Now, the next problem that arises for quantum chemistry is that our molecules or orbitals in a molecules are not spatially connected one after the other. It's not sites that are one-dimensional or two-dimensional or something like that. It's a kind of hodgepodge mix of many things, many different kinds of orbitals, which are either strongly or weakly connected with the next orbitals. For that, actually, there are ways of constructing seniority zero determinants or seniority zero configurations. Seniority zero basically means that if I have an orbital, I always create closed shell configurations. So essentially, if I promote two orbitals from HOMO to LUMO, I have created a seniority zero orbital, seniority zero configuration where LUMO is occupied. Then I can create the same with LUMO plus one, LUMO plus two, and so on and so forth. And using that, you can see the connections between the HOMO and the LUMO, or the LUMO plus one, and so on. So using that, those small calculations, basically you can take that small space and see which orbital is most strongly connected to which orbital. And from that, you can create a kind of a linear mapping of what would be the best way to order the orbitals. That's what we do next. And using that, in these polyaromatic hydrocarbons, where I had previously posited that it's very difficult to calculate the exact wave function because of exponential increase in size, we have calculated the singlet triplet gaps. So this is the gap between the ground state singlet and the first triplet state of these polyaromatic polyacene systems. So this is what it looks like. And then what we actually went ahead and did, because these are kind of isoelectronic systems, but because of the different geometries and different arrangements of single bonds and double bonds and so on, they are expected to have different properties. We wanted, so the idea was, for a good singlet fission material, we need the singlet triplet gap to be reasonably low and the system size to be not too high. So I essentially want a small molecule which has a low enough singlet triplet gap. That's the aim. In order to achieve that aim, we started with polyazulene. So the 7-5 systems are called azulenes. You see that when I start with a single 7-5 motif, I have a very low singlet triplet gap, but the moment I increase the size, the rate of decrease of singlet triplet gap is not that high. So our original hypothesis that, okay, we'll have a polyazulene system and thereby we'll have a fantastic singlet fission material didn't work. Then we went ahead and synthesis papers that says that these kind of fused acene azulene systems can be synthesized, at least till certain system sizes. Therefore, we went ahead and calculated for these systems. And here we see that the singlet triplet gap starts from below, because of course that one is just same as azulene, right? So there's a 7-membered ring and a 5-membered ring. But the moment we stick 6-membered ring in between, actually the rate of change of singlet triplet gap was pretty high, as high as in polyacenes. So that was great, because now we have found that how to engineer a small molecule which can have very small singlet triplet gap. In fact, you will notice over here, so the zero is not here, it's here. So after 5 or 6 membered rings, six ring systems, you see that there's a singlet-triplet crossover. In other words, the triplet state becomes more stable than the singlet state. So we have inadvertently, without trying, we have created magnetic materials out of these completely non-magnetic looking systems. So we were very happy with that result.
Questions?
Yes.
So I think I kind of missed, maybe it's a naive question. So understand that your computational basis is the Fock space. I didn't get why you needed to have orbitals as well. Is it, I mean, is it kind of the space where you're sampling your configurations only?
Oh, so basically, maybe I didn't explain properly. So orbital, how do I create the Fock space? The Fock space is created from different occupations of different orbitals. So we will have some orbitals which are occupied and some of them which are unoccupied. Let's say I have M orbitals and N electrons. And now the problem becomes how many different ways can I put N electrons in those M orbitals? So that is, of course, an exponentially scaling problem because there are N factorials and M factorials coming in that equation. Did I answer your question?
I see. So how do you do sampling then with the MPS?
In DMRG, we sample it this way. We basically take two orbitals at first. So we basically first arrange the orbitals in a single file, one-dimensional way. Let's say I take a very simple example of many hydrogen atoms. So, 10, 50, 100 hydrogen atoms, one after the other, each of the hydrogen atoms would have one 1s orbital. And each of those 1s orbitals, I have kept one after the other. So if I take the first two 1s orbitals, I can create the all possible combinations of configurations from the these two 1s orbitals, right? So it can be both the electrons on one of the 1s orbital or both the electrons on the other 1s orbital and so on. So there can be different combinations. From that different combinations, we can create the density matrix over that wave function. Now I have a wave function which is multi-configuration only in the left-hand side and uniform, whatever uniform in the other part. So with taking that full Hamiltonian, I can create a density matrix, rather taking that full wave function, I can create a density matrix. That density matrix I can diagonalize. Once I diagonalize those density matrix, I let's say retain only two from the four or whatever. I mean, we don't start dropping so quickly. We actually take it to quite a few steps and then we start dropping. But just as an example, let's say I retain only the most important 2 degrees of freedom. So now I have two directions, but in doing that diagonalization of the density matrix, I have changed the basis also. So I am now in this best possible basis, or obviously the singular value basis or the eigenvalue basis. And I have retained only the most important degrees of freedom. So I have reduced the degrees of freedom, but still the rest of the system is just sitting idly with one configuration each. Now, if I again take the possible combinations with the next part of the system, I can again do the same thing over and over again. Do I make sense? Did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much. And the gap, okay. How do you compute the gap? How do you compute the gap in your next slide? After this one. I think after yes. Again. Yes, how do you compute the gap here?
Okay. So I can do a one wave function. Once I will solve for the singlet state, once I will solve for the triplet state, I will get two energies which are converged. I will just take a difference.
Okay, so that's a difference. Okay, sounds good.
Yeah, okay, great.
Thank you.
Okay, so we were here. So actually, we were very excited when we found, or rather, we would like to say we engineered these different kinds of fused acene-azulenes, which are really small molecules, and yet you can get a singlet-triplet crossover. But then we asked the question, why? Why is it below? I mean, why is the triplet state becoming more stable than the singlet state? So what is normally done in these systems is to find a correlation between singlet-triplet gap and homolumo gap, or singlet-triplet gap and diradical nature. Both of them kind of give the same picture in mind. So here we have plotted the singlet-triplet gap versus the occupation, how much of the LUMO is occupied by it. So basically, this gives a measure of the diradical nature. If a LUMO is completely occupied by one electron, then essentially the HOMO has one electron and the LUMO has one electron. And this is two radicals on these two orbitals. So that's a real complete diradical. But of course, since we are in this multi-reference picture, it won't be a full one occupation number. It will be some fraction of it. Or even more. I don't know what I will get. So I have basically tried to see the correlation between singlet-triplet gap and the occupation number of LUMO. And what you can get is like this, which is, of course, there's no correlation. I mean, I can try to draw a line between anything and anything. That does not mean anything. So we were quite confused. And around this time, we came across this paper, which to a chemist sounded like a different system altogether. So they were talking about frustrated two-leg spin-half ladders with skewed rung. So essentially, when they have a ladder-like system, there are skewed rungs. They are saying that there's spin frustration involved. And because of spin frustration, they are getting different quantum phases. In other words, they are seeing that the triplet phases become more stable, or even higher spin states become more stable than the singlet state. So you can see now, just looking at the connections, that this 7-5 skewed rung really looks like a 7-membered ring and a 5-membered ring, and this 7-membered ring and a 5-membered ring, and so on. So the connections look similar to what we have in the polyazulenes, at least the systems they're talking about. These are like polyazulene systems. And just the connections shouldn't mean much, but really in each of these sites or each of these atoms, we basically have a pz orbital, which is giving one electron to each of these systems. And they would be interacting with its adjacent system, essentially like what you would see in a Heisenberg nearest neighbor interaction, or Hubbard nearest neighbor interaction, or something like that. So what we wanted to do was to check whether we can take our systems, remove all the lattice degrees of freedom, in other words, the variation in the bond length, then remove all the details of the molecular Hamiltonian, so have only nearest neighbor interactions, not far away interactions, not one body, two body like that, explicitly those kind of interactions. So the first problem that happens over here is, in order to do that, I will have to find the parameter J, which is actually suitable for my molecular system. I cannot take any J and expect to get the same phenomena I would get from my molecular system. So we went back and looked at some of the literature. There's all, of course, the really old papers which refers to the Landes interval rule, where basically the J parameter is a difference between energy at the highest spin state and highest minus one spin state. And here you can see DMRG calculations on this molecule using different M or different bond dimensions. And you can see that you can get very varied J parameters. But however, if you have converged the calculation. So if you increase the M, finally it gets converged. In those situations, actually, the J parameters are not too bad. And for that matter, you would also notice that from inorganic chemistry, already there are experimental estimates of these J parameters that are available. And these matches reasonably well with the experimental values. The other way of looking at the same problem would be, I'm starting with a molecular Hamiltonian and I'm trying to reach an effective Hamiltonian. That effective Hamiltonian in my case is the Heisenberg Hamiltonian, but essentially it could be any other way where I'm basically decomposing the total space into the most important part of the model space and the outer space. And it is essentially how you decouple these two spaces. That's how you can create different kinds of effective Hamiltonians, such as these Bloch Hamiltonian or Van Vleck Hamiltonians and so on. And in fact, in that same line, there's a lot of body of work by Mulrew and co-workers, where they have shown the relationship between these J parameters and the hopping or the the interaction terms and so on. So using all of these, we kind of tested out a whole array of different ways of building model Hamiltonians. And we at least saw for our system that this Landes rule was very stable and they were giving the same results as the Bloch Hamiltonians. So we went with the kind of Landes rule kind of a way, which is a simple energy gap to estimate the J values. And after we did that, there's a few other corroborating evidence, which I'm not showing over here. But what we really saw is that in case of the polyacenes, the most important configuration is a completely spin unfrustrated configuration. As in, there's always a up spin and a down spin, which are next to each other. So it seems like everybody is happy with each other, with their neighbors. However, because of these odd number of rules, which is kind of expected, the most important configurations happen to have two up spins or two down spins, which kind of come and clump together. And in order to reduce the total number of such bad interactions, they actually put the the spin frustration in the common bonds. In case of polyazulenes, the number of such bad spin frustrated configurations are lower, as in connections are lower. But in case of fused acene azulenes, these are more in number. And this is what is destabilizing the singlet state. If the singlet state gets destabilized, therefore the singlet triplet gap reduces. And at one point, of course, the triplet becomes more stable. Of course, we didn't just confirm with these configurations and get happy. We basically looked at the molecular geometry, which also showed similar evidence. So they were bond length elongation only on those bonds, which actually give rise to these spin frustrated configurations. So the most important configuration, wherever the spin frustration was localized, there you see it's like a repulsion that is happening and the bond length is elongating. So that's another observation that kind of proved that this model Hamiltonians, what they were saying, and the molecular Hamiltonians, which I as a chemist am more comfortable with, are kind of telling the same story. Around this time,
yes. I have a quick question about that, because when you started with modeling with that effective Hamiltonian, you mentioned that you wash away basically the spatial degrees of freedom. So all the distances were the same. Now you're talking about elongation again. So how did you come back to taking into account?
I didn't quite get your question. Can you say that again? I couldn't hear it properly. Sorry.
So I'm saying that when you started with modeling the effective Hamiltonian, you talk about washing the spatial degrees of freedom. So mm-hmm. You don't take into account, so let's say all the distances are the same.
Yes.
But now when you are doing some kind of reverse engineering, when you understand that, okay, there's this frustration that brings about mm-hmm. the fact that the singular state is not stable, And coming back at the molecular level, you see that there's a relationship with the distance. So how do you reverse engineer the effective Hamiltonian to have
how to think about it? Yeah, essentially, let's say I kind of think about it this way. So let's say I take this molecule, the polyazulene, and here there's a upspin and an upspin which are next to each other. So if I had, like in this case, I had taken the same J parameters for all bonds. This kind of means that all the bond lengths are same. So I had forced the molecule into being into having bonds that are all equal. So I can do two things, and I have done two things. One is to test with a molecule where the geometry is such that there are no bond distortions. All of the bonds are same length. And you see that you basically have this different ordering of singlet state, which is more stable, which is less stable. That is one thing that happens. The other thing to look about is if I had kind of to use this logic that if I had pushed all of these bonds to be equal length, however, all the other bonds are happy and these two species are kind of repelling each other. So this bond will become unhappy and therefore this will lead to a bond distortion which elongates that bond. So, and we really did see that if I relax the geometry, then that bond becomes longer. So this kind of two-pronged approach basically tells us that without the bond degrees of freedom, indeed I will have a situation where this is the least stable and then this for the singlet state. And then if I left the bonds to be, to do whatever they want to, then because there's a repulsion here, that bond becomes elongated. Okay?
Yes, thanks.
Yeah. So now comes the next part of the problem and probably where I really want to reach this audience. It's then we got greedy as always and we wanted to solve this problem for a two-dimensional system. Let's say a small graphene patch or something like that. How would I go about it? Because see, for one-dimensional system, DMRG is actually super efficient to find these singlet states or the triplet states or whatnot. But for a truly two-dimensional system, I don't have a way of placing the orbitals such that the degrees of freedom, such that the entanglement remains reasonable. For example, let's say this is my two-dimensional systems, and if I snake my way through it, then I have taken care of the 1-2 correlation very well, but I have done a very shoddy job of the 1-10 correlation, because then I would have to retain all these entanglement degrees of freedom. And only then I would be able to depict the 1-10 correlation properly. In other words, as the system becomes larger and larger, I would have to retain more and more bond dimensions or more and more M states. The other way of kind of understanding this problem is if I were to break the system into two, the entanglement between these two systems is directly related to the area of the boundary. And in a two-dimensional system, the boundary, whichever way you choose to break the system, increases with system size. For one-dimensional system, however, you can elongate it ad nauseum. It doesn't care because the boundary still remains the same and therefore the M states does not grow. And again, notice my molecular systems can sometimes be somewhat one-dimensional, but not always. Mostly it's a three-dimensional mess. And I would like to be able to calculate for those quantum chemical systems also. So around this time, we actually looked at this paper by Carleo and Troyer in Science, where they talked about tensor product states and how restricted Boltzmann machines can be used to find the wave function of quantum systems. Of course, what they did was a variational solution using the restricted Boltzmann machine as an ansatz. So essentially, if I replace the wave function with the restricted Boltzmann machine form of function, and then variationally solve that, would I be able to get a good energy? That's what they proved was possible. But if it can be solved variationally, the problem should also be equally solved. I don't know about the equally part, but it should be possible to solve it using machine learning. That's where we started thinking that basically we want an ansatz, and of course we were totally naive about restricted Boltzmann machines and stuff. So we started with a simple neural network. So essentially my wave function now is a function that looks like this, where W is the waves and the phi is, you could think about it as the upspin or the downspin of the sides, or it could be the occupation number of spins of orbitals. We actually took spin orbitals, so even there it was zeros or ones. There was no two and up and down. We didn't have those coded in our system. So now what I need is essentially a function f of x, which is quite flexible because it would have to mimic the actual wave function of the system. And I would have to train it such that f becomes my ansatz is close to the true function. And the f of x isn't too complicated a form. It's easy to optimize, things like that. So that's what we did. And instead of minimizing with energy or the variational optimization, we tried to optimize W to mimic the data. We tried to optimize the weights to mimic the data. Now, what is the data over here? The data for our case were the known weights or the CI coefficients. So I have the ansatz where I wrote it as a CI coefficient times configuration. So if I have a bunch, any bunch of configurations, and for that bunch of configurations, if I know the weights or I know the relative weights, would I be able to learn the relative weights of the rest of the Hilbert space? That's essentially how we have posed the problem. In other words, we want to minimize the cost function between fx minus exact y of x, and the tuning parameters over here are the weights W. So the question, first question to ask is, what is the benefit? Well, we don't have to compute the energy, which is always required for any variational problem. So if we basically took the matrix product state into a tensor product state, there's something I actually tried during my PhD a bit. For molecular systems or for quantum chemical systems, we were facing the problem that computing the energy and taking the energy derivatives and things like that was becoming way too expensive. And in fact, while optimizing them, the noise was becoming much larger than the actual gain. So that's essentially the problem we had faced with the variational approach. Therefore, this would, we believed, would be an alternative approach. The network, as I mentioned, was a simple neural network structure, and therefore the number of parameters I am going to deal with scales as n squared. Here, of course, the n is the number of nodes, and we had taken the nodes as really the number of orbitals equal to the number of nodes. So the number of parameters was scaling as n squared with the system size. So we went to these two-dimensional polyaromatic hydrocarbons. You can think that this is not two-dimensional enough, and you are right, but we couldn't, I mean, our system, the amount of training data we required exploded on us, and we couldn't do anything larger. That's the truth. So here you can see that if you find the most important subspace of the from the Hilbert space and do a diagonalization in the final step in that subspace to find the energy, you can reach the exact full CI values at reasonable system size or sub-Hilbert space size. So the final variational energy of ANNCI was in fact accurate. Another point I must point out over here. So what data do I train with? I actually use a Monte Carlo sampling to begin with to find out the relative weights of the relative configuration interaction weights of the sub-Hilbert space. So that's how I build my training data. I don't train on the full CI wave function because that essentially means I've solved the problem, then I'm trying to see if it's if it can be machine learned. That has already been done, I think, around 2018 or some such time. So what we did was we trained from initial steps of Monte Carlo, and from that we tried to extend that learning to the full Hilbert space. But that still doesn't solve our problem because as I mentioned, the amount of data required for training was increasing with system size. And therefore, even though I can say that it scales as n squared, but there's a scaling that is hidden, which is the amount of training data. And we weren't quite sure how badly that was scaling, probably really evilly. So we had to think of other approaches. And around that time, we found this paper by Staudenmayer, where they had looked at matrix product states to train handwriting recognition. And so we used the same algorithm, really exactly the same algorithm. And we saw that that algorithm was actually very similar to a two-dot DMRG algorithm. It still did not require the computation of energy. So we didn't have to think of matrix product operators and stuff like that too much. And we trained using the answers that we now used was MPS, and the MPS itself was being machine learned from the configuration interaction values of the Monte Carlo sample. Just a small interlude over here. So if I go scaling wise, so if I have a one-dimensional DMRG that scales as order k cubed or order n cubed with system size, for an MPO-based algorithm, it scales as order n fourth, as is given in these papers. And if I were trying to optimize MPS, so matrix product state via machine learning, it scales as linear with respect to system size times NT. And here we think NT scales, we think because we don't know yet, scales as n squared. So it has somewhat similar scaling as DMRG, but we believe that once we go to a two-dimensional system where the energy computation itself is challenging to the point of excruciating, we will have an advantage. That's what the hope is at the moment. We have shown that using this optimizing MPS with machine learning indeed works. And it works because the cost function that we have chosen versus the energy, there's a nice correlation. And you can see over here. So if you see, this is the MCCI, so Monte Carlo value, you can get quite a few orders of magnitude closer to the full CI energy once you learn the MPS using machine learning. Small issues about molecular problems, and one of the most excruciating molecular problem is indeed bond breaking problem, because it looks like a small system, you know, like the water bond breaking, but it's a very difficult problem to solve because at different parts of the potential energy surface, different kinds of interactions take over. And here you can see why, even as a machine learning problem, it's a difficult one, because if you kind of show the CI coefficients. So let's say the modulus of CI or some kind of a transformation which was used in a previous paper. So if you use these kind of measure of the importance of the configurations, you see that they kind of bunch in one place. So there's the red bunch over here, which is the transform CI. So red bunch over here, and then some red bunches over here. Similarly, for the absolute CI, you see there's a huge bunch over here and some more over here, which you cannot see. If you kind of zoom in, this is what you see. So if you have all your data bunched at one place, it's very difficult to learn it.
So those data, are they coming from Monte Carlo?
No, those data are from full CI. We are first trying to understand what would be the good measure to learn for a bond breaking problem.
Okay.
So essentially the data balancing kind of becomes an issue. On the other hand, if you have a measure such as this log CI, which is finally what we ended up using for the bond breaking problem, if you have a log CI, there's a reasonably nice distribution. And this reasonably, most importantly, this reasonably nice distribution is throughout the bonding curve, as in when it's in the equilibrium versus when it's half of the bond is broken versus when it's, you know, broken to smithereens. So at throughout that region, this distribution is there. And as a result of that, these are much better to learn because here you see the percentage of correlation that you can recover using log CI value is actually pretty much better than the other measures that were used before. And again, if you plot the potential energy surface, this is what it looks like. But if you kind of zoom in, you will see that there are crinkles and stuff like that. And still, the log CI gives the lowest amount of crinkles and bumps and strange features. So logarithmic of CI coefficient, at least for the bond breaking problem, is the most effective. But this kind of, I wanted to highlight this is because chemists or physicists, we kind of tend to think that model Hamiltonians and molecular Hamiltonians have kind of a nice interrelationship with them and we can go from the one to the other easily, but we have found it the hard way that that's not quite true. So that's one part. The final thing that we have been trying to achieve, and to some extent we have only some preliminary data, is to use generative learning. So from the initial MCCI, like we took some samples of configurations to learn the CI expansion as an ANN or the CI expansion as a MPS. If we just take the sample and try to find the probability density using restricted Boltzmann machine, we can generate new configurations. From that, get a better measure of the importance. And if we keep doing this till convergence, we actually can have a more wholesome method for these molecular systems. In fact, even for the bond breaking problem, this is a much more stable algorithm. However, we have only preliminary data over here, very small basis sets and things like that. So let me conclude here with, I hope to have explained that these few stacene azulenes, which we were very excited about, indeed shows the first really small molecules where the singlet-triplet crossover is possible. And the reason for that is largely due to spin frustration. That we hope will provide new design strategies, new design principles to kind of tune the singlet-triplet gaps for different uses, be it singlet fission or magnetic material or you name it. We have been able to achieve extension to two-dimensional systems using artificial neural network, and then also we have shown that the MPS optimization using machine learning is possible for, again, this one is of course for one-dimensional systems. And we have been able to use generative learning to speed up Monte Carlo. But we have a really long wish list of methods we want to test. We are testing. We are getting funny results at times and so on. And there are some problems which are inherent to quantum chemistry that has a very different data structure, as in the weights and stuff are really weirdly skewed. And those, I mean, I, yeah, I, I kind of feel that's why quantum chemistry kind of runs into these hurdles of why it's not solvable, because you would think it should be easily solvable, because we are always only talking about the low energy spectrum of any molecular system. So any kind of renormalization should work like great, but it doesn't. Or it does at a limit where our computers kind of conk off. Yeah. So before I end, let me thank the people who worked with me to achieve most of this and funding from various sources. And thank you all for listening, especially at this very early hour. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Debashe. Questions?
Debashe, I have a short question.
Sure.
You mentioned about a problem very specific to quantum chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
See, one of the thing is absence of translation invariance even in small system.
Yes.
So it's very difficult because we always in condensed matter physics enjoy.
Yeah, we have a lot of boundary. I mean, I used to think that because we have small molecules, it will be much nicer, but actually it's the opposite. Yeah.
So there are studies using random circuits these days.
Mm-hmm.
Random qubits, randomly connected.
So
some of those insights, I mean, that looks like locally quantum chemistry, very inhomogeneous and so on.
Oh, so some of this, if you can send some of those literature my way, because that's, I don't know if in chemistry there's much thought in that direction. I would love to take it.
I'm not an expert. I've just come across. Then another small comment is, you showed about the 5-ring and 7-member ring getting frustrated. See, another thing that happens is local spin chirality develops there.
You mean spin current, as in
spin current locally, yeah.
Those
which
currents,
is related to spin chirality.
Yeah.
But I have discussed with Manoranjan long back in detail. So that just
actually Manoranjan helped me in that first project quite a lot, incidentally.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah.
So. Thank you very much. Thanks for a nice talk.
Thank you.
Bridging quantum chemistry to machine
learning. Yeah, this wonderful. Is kind of, I'm falling in along the edge of both, and we are struggling quite a bit.
But it's amazing. Sorry, another short comment. I heard a talk by a colleague at IIT Madras.
Mm-hmm.
How in excited states things are so different. New chemical reactions.
Absolutely.
Amazing. Yeah.
Absolutely different, because the potential energy surface is completely different than ground state.
Different.
So this
is something that we physicists, condensed matter physicists, are often ignored. We are sitting in an equilibrium situation and very low energy excitations. You break bonds and so on.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe a quick question.
Sure.
First off, thanks. We're running, like Bhaskaran said, we're running a course here this week at Perimeter that touches on tensor networks and machine learning, and your talk fit perfect into it. So thanks so much. I just wanted to, maybe I missed it, but the MPS optimization with machine learning. So what you've done there is you basically replaced the deterministic, DMRG type optimization with one that's based on gradient descent.
Yes.
Basically.
Yes, exactly.
I wasn't aware of too many cases where that performs better. I think it's pretty interesting.
No, I didn't say it performs better though, because with DMRG, if you are in one dimension, it will almost never be better. But we are hoping that in two dimensions where DMRG fails miserably, this kind of an algorithm will still hold.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing, dimensionally, there's nothing complicated here. As in gradient descent will still remain gradient descent. And we don't calculate energies and stuff like that. So this is going to be invariant to dimensionality, which is of course not true for DMRG. But in one dimensions, no, we are definitely not better. We actually benchmark with DMRG. So,
okay. Yeah. Thanks for that clarification. Got it. And thanks again for a great talk. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
other questions? Actually, I have questions.
Yeah.
On the 2D side with MPS, my understanding is that you use data to train, right?
The first one for the 2D, we used ANN. So that there we were not, there was no MPS.
Okay.
This one has no MPS.
What was the data you used to train?
Can you say that again, please?
The data you used to train. So what is the cost function you used to train here?
Oh, the data is the CI coefficients. We are predicting the CI coefficients and training on the CI coefficients. Actually, the minus log of CI coefficients.
I see. So you predict on the fly and then you train on the fly.
Yes. Yeah. We actually have an active learning module where we improve the training model as we go. Yeah.
So what is the cost function? I'm still not getting what is the cost function.
Oh, okay. So if this f of x is the minus log of mod ci that I'm predicting, and this is the minus log of mod ci that is already known to us from Monte Carlo.
I see. So you have a labeled data that you get from Monte Carlo, but yes. Then you have a cost of getting those labeled data from Monte Carlo.
Yeah.
I see. So the other thing I wanted to understand is how costly is it to compute the energy? Because you mentioned that you tried the variational minimizing the Hamiltonian over some variational ANSAT, and then the noise was problematic.
For two-dimensional, it was very problematic, yes. But again, for these systems, these are hardly two-dimensional. You know, I can brute force it away. Okay.
I see.
But if I keep increasing this patch, DMRG will conk off at one point.
I see. Because if
I increase it in one direction, if I make a nano strip, DMRG will be fine. If I make a nano patch, DMRG will die.
Yeah, that makes sense. That totally makes sense. So I was trying to understand, how when you were computing, when you use as a cost function, the variational energy, did you use like some techniques to control the variance of the gradients? Things like control variance method?
Because you mentioned what you mean by that.
Because there are some techniques you could use to control the gradient of the variational energy when you train over the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, right?
In DMRG or in the machine learning?
In something that is similar to variational Monte Carlo.
No, here we didn't do that. We just took different subspaces and improved the subspace and kept going. This is called MCCI. This is a method that came about in late 90s by John Greer or somebody like that. Yeah.
I see.
That's what got the samples, training samples from. That's what we are benchmarking on at times also.
Maybe my suggestion would be a way, I think I probably mentioned it to you when we asked, a way that could be scalable in 2D where you don't need data to train, where you could generate configurations on the fly and minimize the energy on the fly if the energy is not too costly to compute. And then you could use techniques like automatic differentiation to compute the gradients. Like you don't have to care about it, Python takes care of it. And then you could use things like RNNs where you don't really have to care too much about card sampling. That, yeah. I guess, it could be scalable. Sure.
Yeah, thank you for the suggestion. Yeah.
Sure. Any other questions? Online, any questions? Okay, let's thank Divashi again.